Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our conversation continues with Jenny Main, CFO, Office of Financial Stability within the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Also joining us from IBM is Jeff Smith. Jenny, you've mentioned TARP a couple of times. Would you describe in more depth what the Troubled Asset Relief Program is? What are some of the key programs? How has the strategy evolved since its inception, if it has? The funding level? And more importantly, does this sunset?
Sure. So the Troubled Asset Relief Program, just broadly, one thing I would say over and over, we actually use the statute, the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act statute, as our Bible. Almost everyone has a copy at their desk, and they have a copy at their house, and they might keep one in their bag. So we just go back to it over and over. See, the TARP is the overall authority that was provided for the Secretary of the Treasury to invest in troubled assets from financial institutions. And underneath that, a variety of programs have come about. So the key program that folks are most familiar with probably is the Capital Purchase Program. That was initiated last fall by Secretary Paulson. And that program was really kind of the cornerstone of the notion that addressing the financial stability needs in the capital markets, that the most important thing to do was to make sure that the capital in the banks was sufficient to, you know, sustain any future losses and defaults that might be coming up at levels that would surprise people. The Capital Purchase Program said, we're going to put capital into key banks to make sure that as they start to recognize losses and other challenges that are happening in the economy, they'll have enough cushion there that it won't cause a run and panic in the markets. And that was the cornerstone of that. $125 billion went out. I think it was October 23rd last year. That was the first big chunk of money, nine institutions that were provided those funds. And they were really an investment. It was preferred stock in those companies that was purchased. We've subsequently done another $80 billion or so program. It was about $205 billion grand total that's been invested in over 650 financial institutions, banks around the country. That program is the area where last June, you may have heard, about $70 billion was repaid by a number of the big firms and some smaller ones as well. In conjunction with that, a couple of big institutions, Citigroup and Bank of America, needed additional capital beyond the parameters of the CPP, the Capital Purchase Program. So they created an exceptional kind of program, targeted investment program, was called TIP. Citigroup and Bank of America each got $20 billion in additional capital. They're required to pay the government the dividend on the preferred stock is actually 8%, versus in the CPP program, it's 5%. So it was a little more expensive. One other program to mention, the investment in the in AIG Corporation. They went in and provided a series, actually, of investments and funds for AIG. The TARP portion of that was a $40 billion investment in the fall, followed by a $30 billion revolving fund that was provided last spring. So that's another $70 billion. Another one on the list are the auto programs. Essentially, the government provided GM and Chrysler suppliers programs, total in the $75 billion range. The purpose of those investments were to give the companies time to keep operating while they were looking at private sector alternatives to refinancing their current debt, getting more investors, and or addressing some of their structural costs that they had in terms of, you know, long-term expenses that the companies had developed. Both of those companies ultimately went into bankruptcy over the summer, and the government came out on the other side, if you will, with certain rights. We own 60.8% of the common stock of what we call the new GM. And they've indicated that they, you know, hope to go public in the next, you know, year. We'll realize the value of that investment at that time. There's been the what we call the TALF program, which is the term asset-backed securities. It's the loan facility fund. It's really run by the Fed, but it's a joint program between Treasury and the Fed. The Fed runs it, set up what's called a special purpose vehicle that specifically makes loans to investors who want to buy asset-backed securities. So the asset-backed security market, stepping back one step, people were not buying those asset-backed securities because they were worried about how well they would perform. So the government said, we will set up a program to help incentivize investors to buy this stuff, which will then incentivize the originators to continue putting loans out and making credit available. So that program has a $20 billion investment from the Treasury. The public-private investment program is one that's just rolling out now. It has taken a while. That program is a partnership with private investors who want to purchase troubled assets, in other words, loans and particularly securities. In this case, the PPIP program is for purchasing troubled asset securities that banks and others hold on their books that have gone down in value. These funds will go out and buy these kinds of assets off of a variety of books of financial institutions and create a market and get some price points going so that people can start to see more activity happening in that area. That's a $30 billion program. And then last but not least, the homeownership program is intended to forestall foreclosures, prevent foreclosures, I should say, where borrowers who are in a place where they are not able to make the payments on their mortgage, but with some modest relief, they could, and that will prevent them from losing their homes and having turnover in neighborhoods and communities. So overall, the Secretary is authorized to purchase up to $700 billion of troubled assets. So all the programs I've described, you know, go against that. We have plans in total that total up to $644 billion of the $700 that Treasury has announced that it plans to spend. Of that, $444 has actually been legally obligated. Of that, $365 billion has been dispersed with money out the door. The last point that I would just, in terms of the sunset, programs absolutely sunset this 12/31/09, so at the end of this calendar year, except that the Secretary of the Treasury has the authority to extend that through notification to Congress through potentially the October 3rd of 2010, which is the anniversary of the ESA Act, so no longer than 2 full years it could be in existence.
Well, you mentioned earlier A-123. As a requirement for proper internal controls. Given the scope and complexity, as you just outlined, of the TARP programs, would you give us an overview of how you're building the internal control framework within OFS? And has SBA's experience helped you with that?
Sure. Just to take the SBA question first, in some ways, the government took a pretty big leap forward in 2004 and 2005 after Sarbanes-Oxley was passed for private sector companies to follow. The federal government went ahead and amended its existing internal control requirements to further specify what the standards were around financial reporting, expectations around our own internal management review of our activity, sort of Sarbanes-like activity for the federal government. So I was at SBA at that time and responsible for implementing it there and spent a lot of time there thinking about internal controls and what our core controls were and then what our review process was. So that was very helpful for me coming in fresh with OFS. The overall approach to internal control is I believe I mentioned earlier, this notion of game over. Another analogy we use is follow the money. Start where the big money is and make sure that that is your kind of red zone for controls. So we have belts and suspenders around all of the transactions that we do. And what I mean by that is we have a very strong set of segregation of duties, responsibilities. We have, you know, an investment committee that works with the policy officials that really says, okay, these are the investments that we're going to make. We have a whole separate group of people that's validating, here's the financial information of these entities that are going to receive funds, all the things about wire transfers and where the money's going to and accounts and that kind of thing. We use a custodian, an external custodian that helps us with that as well. And then when we physically do a transaction on a day, we put out $125 billion. So there's a big process leading up to that of really documenting in process maps where you show who all the different parties are and what the key points are and who's going to do what and where it goes. And so then we would have what we'll call a mechanics meeting ahead of time and make sure all the parties are in the room and that everyone goes through and knows exactly what they're going to do on this one day to transfer these funds. And then while we're doing that, we have another team observing right then and checking to make sure that everything was done and checked as planned and identifying any deviations or any issues immediately. So we really put on, like I said, the belts and suspenders. So that's really the key thing that we did. And then we stepped back from there. I think of it a little bit as a picture, an image, where if you go to the core center of it, that's where the money's really moving and the most direct risk is. And that's kind of the red zone. And we've put a lot of resources there. And then we step back each level and say, you know, what other activity is happening around this? And we've been building internal controls kind of going out that way. The statute actually provided that we could implement these programs, you know, without doing all the traditional policies and procedures. We never could have gotten there if we had done that in the sort of traditional government approach. But we have put together policies and procedures in there for a first round of for all of our programs, and they are being completed literally now so that we can make sure we have them all in place. And we've really tried to take internal control just very seriously. We felt like it's not an option in a program like this. So that's been kind of the core of it. And a sort of interesting thing on top of it with A-123, that's where you bring in a team to review and make sure that all the controls are in place. Right. So sort of, you know, a bit of of a funny circumstance where times we were bringing in a team to review things we were just creating like that morning. So, you know, we make it up, you know, we write it up and finalize it that morning, and the A123 team is there in the afternoon to review it. And literally, as we've gotten down to some of the third and fourth quarter things that need to be tested, you know, we might have the A123 review test team in the room doing what is sort of real-time monitoring and observing, because there just isn't anything to go, you know, frequently you would go back to last year's quarter close and be able to see, you know, test what was there. We don't have any of those. It's all first year. Kind of amusing when we think about our financial statements. Usually do a comparison year to year. Well, last year they're all zeros. You know, it's all brand new.
We'll talk more about financial operations, and in a lot of ways you're starting from scratch and setting up the proper financial operations to manage the TARP program, even leveraging the backbone of Treasury's departmental office's infrastructure. Would you tell us more about the challenges you face in this area, especially in the budgeting and accounting of transactions related to the program?
Yeah, I think the hardest part of this has been, it's really quite a technical area. The statute that created the program, ESA, requires us to follow the Federal Credit Reform Act when we do the cost estimates for these programs. When we determine the cost, we shall follow the Federal Credit Reform Act is what it says. And the Federal Credit Reform Act really was of 1990 was really designed around loans and loan guarantees. But as it turns out, we've done a lot of preferred stock and these other kinds of investments that are not exactly loans and loan guarantees. So that has been kind of the key challenging area to bring in resources, people who really understand budgeting and accounting for credit reform. We have a further complication or wrinkle in all of it, in that traditionally the Federal Credit Reform Act, when you think about how you do these, you're calculating the net present value of the future cash flows associated with your transactions. So you think, okay, I'm putting out $100, I'm going to get $10 a year for the next 10 years, some interest, and you use a discount rate. And traditionally, under credit reform, you use the Treasury discount rate of a comparable, you know, maturity term, sort of getting at the Treasury's cost of funds. In our case, the statute says when you do credit reform, use a market risk-adjusted discount rate, which in the finance world, the market risk-adjusted rate is sort of how the private market says, how much would it cost me to raise money? You know, what should be my thought of my level of risk here? And so it is, you know, inherently different than the Treasury rate for a reason, right? There's a distinction there. And that has been an added twist that we've really had to work through how to implement that and be true to the statute and the requirement. But at the same time, as a practical matter, you know, Treasury actually does borrow at a lower rate than the market risk-adjusted discount rate. So those pieces have been by far the most complex. We, in addition to needing a new team of accountants and budget people, we've also had to grapple with these new and different accounting and budget requirements. I think the key strategy has been to bring a combination of private sector folks with good commercial accounting and just commercial investment experience, combine that with some folks with good federal credit reform experience, and say, okay, let's bring the two of these together so we can resolve the, you know, outstanding issues and move forward and get it executed.
When you described the TARP program, you talked about some of the initiatives around housing, and we know that a stable housing market is essential for economic recovery. Around $50 billion of TARP funds are part of the effort to stabilize the market. Would you tell us more about the Home Affordable Modification Program and similar ones to stabilize the market and support homeowners? And as a follow-up, how challenging is it for you to track the funds dispersed by these programs?
The HAMP program, the Home Affordable Modification Program, is actually the key TARP program in the housing area and the foreclosure prevention. We work with servicers, who are the folks who service loans, collect the payments each month from borrowers, and then usually forward them on to these investors who are ultimately holding the rights to these payments. And so we work with servicers to have them go out and work with their borrowers who are 60 days, you know, delinquent on their loans. Those are the key, you know, target group, trying to identify if the loans were modified and the interest payment was reduced based on a certain formula that we've put out there. Then the borrower would be in a better position to continue to make the payments. That's the conceptual part of it. Usually in the market, you know, the housing market, they would do kind of a trial period, maybe a 90-day trial period where they would do a modification. The borrower, you know, submits some information, says, I'm going to need a modification. I'm having trouble making my payments. The servicer says, okay, we'll work with you. We'll look at this. And after, you know, 90 days, 3 months of a trial mod, then they would go and make it official and really re-sign the documents. For those of you who've, you know, closed on a house, you know there's a lot of materials closing on those loans. So you go and do it officially after 3 months. What we're dealing with is trying to figure out from a budget perspective how many of these that go into the trial period are actually going to enter into the final period. We've found, I think there's a fair amount of literature about out there, that even when you have folks entering into a modification in their mortgage, they're usually in some financial distress. And it's not a done deal that just getting a modification is going to make sure that they don't default. So we don't see 100% of folks who get into the modification program going all the way through. This is, you know, from other programs. We don't have enough experience in ours yet to be able to see. But that's really what we're looking at carefully and trying to think from a budget perspective, how much will this cost? The main thing we're doing is tracking very carefully all the data that we're getting in. Fannie Mae in particular works directly with the servicers and has them reporting data on the borrowers and how the borrowers are doing the payments. We see all that data coming through to us, but it really comes through Fannie Mae, and they help us quite a bit with their expertise in that area. But the challenge has been, the budget challenge has been particularly around what does it really all translate to? And I think, you know, really the best we can do is put in place a good process to continue to monitor it and update our assumptions based on the experience that we're seeing. And it's really still quite early to actually tell that part.
Jenny, I only have a minute, but I wanted to touch on this. Given the sums that you're dealing with in the program, would you tell us a little bit about the TARP oversight bodies and how do you work with them?
There are four major oversight bodies. GAO, which is an existing institution and, you know, big player in Washington, has been. So they have a separate unit that's really focused on us. And as I mentioned, they're doing our financial statement audit. The Special Inspector General for the TARP, known as the SIGTARP, so Special Inspector General for the TARP, was created just to oversee our function and does mostly what a traditional inspector general would do, just focused on this one area as opposed to a whole department. The Congressional Oversight Panel was created as well, and they look at a variety of things about our organization and programs. And then there's the Financial Stability Oversight Board, which is the Treasury Secretary and the head of the SEC and a number of others that are providing sort of overall policy review and guidance. You know, there's really good attitudes across the board, a real commitment to working together, and that everyone's on the same page trying to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse in these programs, to do our very best as stewards of the taxpayers to make sure that the money is being spent effectively and, you know, those kinds of questions. So overall, it's been a positive experience, and I think a major effort has been made on all parts to, you know, act in good faith and work together.
How has the role of the CFO evolved within the federal government? We will ask Jenny Main, CFO, Office of Financial Stability within the U.S. Department of Treasury, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.